Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we are so pleased to welcome back to the program this morning David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies here at the University of Illinois. He's also, in fact, director of the Unit for Cinema Studies. And every once in a while he's here and we talk about movies. We are now embarked upon the big summer movie season. So maybe you're excited about that. Maybe you're not. We have had now, I think, the first official big star, big hype, big action movie, Mission Impossible 3, has premiered. And if that doesn't do it for you, in about 10 days you can get in line and see The Da Vinci Code, and then there will be others throughout the summer. There may actually be some movies that people will remember for longer than a week afterwards. No telling. But this is your opportunity here to call and ask questions, to talk about movies. We've talked in the past a little bit about the business of movies and how it is they're made. And it's also your opportunity to talk about movies that you have seen recently. Perhaps there's something that you've seen that you thought was particularly good and you'd like to recommend it to other people who are listening. Or perhaps there's also something that you've seen you thought was terrible and you'd like to say, save your money, go someplace else, don't see that movie, it's no good. Any and all of that is certainly welcome. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have questions, you can call us. Thanks for being here once again.
My pleasure.
I had the opportunity when the Ebert Fest was going on to talk with two of the directors who were here for the festival. I talked with Phil Morrison, who directed the movie Junebug, and I talked with Haji Hand, who directed this movie called Somebody's. Junebug people actually can see if they haven't seen it because it's on DVD.
Right.
Somebody's, they don't have distribution yet for the movie, so
right.
Who knows if anybody's ever going to be able to see it. But this, for both of these guys, this was their first feature film. And one of the things I asked them both was how much it cost to make the movie. And Phil said, I know that's rude, you're never supposed to ask that. Phil said that, I don't remember the exact figure, but I know that it was less than $800,000, which seems to me an extraordinarily small amount of money. And Haji, he said, I don't know, I don't want to know, but I can't imagine it was,
no,
that
it was one
was more.
Yeah, it was more than that.
It was more than
he
that.
He shot that on video.
So that gets to the question, now these days, what's it cost to make a movie? What's the average cost for making a movie?
A Hollywood movie?
Yeah.
$50 million.
Uh-huh.
And that's, you know, they now distinguish between sort of the, there's a weird word they use for your sort of franchise movie called a tentpole movie, which is supposed to hold up the studio's, you know, budget line and cash flow for the year. And those movies, if you can bring in one for under $100 million, you've done a good job.
And that's what would be a movie like Mission Impossible or the X-Men or
Pirates
of the Caribbean.
Right.
Or
yeah. And those
like
are those are I think I read where Superman Returns was $185.
Wow.
Dollars.
And is that $185.
$185.
And is that how much of that is what it takes to make the movie, particularly special effects? And how much of that is if you have a big star, you're going to have to pay that person a lot of money?
Well, it's a combination. The stars are getting anywhere from 10 to 20. A lot of stars that have confidence in their movies are taking points. So if they think it's really going to gross a lot of money, they get it at the, you know, at the back end. But the just the cost of labor is just, you know, I don't want to say outrageous, but you know, I mean, cost, you have to pay people what they're worth. And I'm talking about, you know, most people don't stay through the credits at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do, because it's another 5 to 10 minutes of time, and that's because just think that everybody whose name you see there has had to have gotten paid. And none of them are getting $5.50 an hour. And so it just cost a lot of money when, you know, everything from stars and the director and all of the important crafts people to just, you know, down the line, it's just cost a lot of money. These days, you know, Hollywood's tried to save money by what Hollywood calls runaway production, which is their word for movies not made in Hollywood any longer. So, you know, Vancouver and Toronto become every city that they want to be. And labor costs there. And of course, there's a lot of shooting overseas now. One place that's really been trying to advertise itself as a good place to make movies cheaply, but with good labor and, you know, skilled people is China. Nice start going to China and making movies, of course. But even there, you know, it just cost a lot of money. I actually read an interesting theory, which I think I agree with, that for the most part, movie stars are in fact overpaid for the money that they'll generate. So there you go.
Even
I hope no one's listening.
Even
but,
Tom Cruise, somebody like that, is over. I mean, don't want that movie make a boatload of.
Well, money. Yes and no. I mean, this was just the theory that if you take my theory is that the stars don't sell movies, but that stars are important for all of the ancillary things, such as what would Oprah Winfrey be without Tom Cruise. What would all of the magazines be, you know, everywhere from TV Guide to the National Enquirer? So movies participate in celebrity culture, and it's all kind of wrapped up in one thing, is my feeling. But just in terms of a movie, and you can, you know, if you name the people who you think of as who's a star, you'll find that many times their movies don't even return the salaries of the stars. Right, not gross, but return. How much are they actually bringing back? And so, you know, you could really think of half a dozen stars, so-called, who really don't sell a movie. Now, Tom Cruise may be a super exception, and we'll see. Tom Hanks may be a super exception. But even there, you could argue that they're overpaid to the extent that they won't generate as much box office as people sometimes think.
Well, we have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that. Someone listening in Bloomington, Illinois, on our line number one. Here we go. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
A question for your guest. At the beginning of the movie, you see several different companies advertised with their logos. And
right.
Then you'll see producer, assistant to the producer. could your guest explain those relationships and who's actually doing what? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Thanks. Okay. Well, thank you.
Most of the movies that are released by Hollywood studios are actually made. Some of them are co-made, co-produced, but many of them are produced by these companies that you see. And typically you'll see anywhere from one besides this. Let's say it's Warner Brothers, but it might be, you know, X company distributed by Warner Brothers or in partnership with. So because movies cost so much money, and even an independent movie, you know, it's all relative. But because movies cost so much money, the major studios are either putting in some of the money up front or only distributing, and somebody else has put some of the money up front. So there's a lot of important producing companies, and most of the big stars have their own production company. So that's why you see so many. And then oftentimes you'll find, especially in a middle budget movie, you'll find foreign producers in there. So sometimes you might see Canal Plus, for instance. That's a very popular one. Or for an indie movie, you might see Channel 4, a subsidiary of the BBC. So it's the people who are putting – the companies who are putting money in up front, and then the distributor might come in either to help or at the back end. So it'll say so-and-so in association with, you know, presented by Warner Brothers. And sometimes there's six or seven of them. Now, the producer – is the person who handles the actual finances and typically is involved to get all of the people together to make the movie. The executive producer, which is a fairly common thing, is someone who sort of lends their name to the project and will step in if they have to be. But really, the executive producer is kind of like a godfather. I don't mean that literally. I say kind. We make him an offer he can't refuse. You put in my nephews. So he's not literally the godfather, but he's like a godfather. But the most important person is the producer. Associate producers are people who sort of help on there. But, you know, there's guilds in Hollywood that actually are the Producers Guild, the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild, the Actors Guild. And the guild that's becoming very active is the Producers Guild, because they're actually getting tired of so many producing credits: producer, co-producer, associate producer, line producer. So it's all people who, you know, put up money, help put up money, find the money, etc. So there really is a it really works that way. But the most important person in the front end is actually the producer. But that's really the way it works. The major studios, you know, will Hollywood releases about, well, major pictures about 260 a year. And of those, the major studios fully fund maybe only a third. And so it really is your spyglass entertainment, or some, which is one of the ones I like. Now, that was Spielberg's company, right? SKG DreamWorks. That's what DreamWorks was, although that was like a major because of the importance of Spielberg and Katzenberg and all that. But that's what those companies are. And as I say, most every major actor has a company. And for that Mission Impossible, you'll notice, was produced by Tom Cruise and his producing partner, a woman whose name I forget. But that's the way it really works. And so, people want to take control over their careers. And that's what, as I say, directors, producers, many actors have their own sort of funding companies.
Well, are there some of the people who have listed as producers, are there people there who have done nothing more than sign a check?
That's why the Producers Guild is concerned about that. People who have signed a check or really might be on the back end, at the end credits. Nowadays, some movies have no credits at the beginning at all, but you only have the most important credits at the beginning, and that's where the Producers Guild is really becoming sort of concerned, in that, in fact, these people aren't actually producers, and it dilutes what producers do and what producers are. And you remember, when you get your Academy Award for Best Picture, the person who accepts the award is the producer. The director doesn't go. The director gets the director's award, unless it's Ang Lee, and then he doesn't have to. Or if it's whatever. Every time the director might be the producer, but generally speaking, it's not. And that's why you'll see the person who goes up to accept the Best Picture is, in fact, a producer. And so, again, the Producers Guild wants to ensure that the credit means something. It's very strange in Hollywood. It really is a kind of weird thing. All kinds of favors people get, it credits that they don't deserve. Actually, the strangest credit for me has always been the screenwriting credit. Not because screenwriters aren't important, but because so many movies have had so many people contribute, and that the only way you can get screenwriting credit, as far as the Writers Guild of America is concerned, is if you can prove that you've written at least 50% of the movie. But, one or two moments, one or two scenes, some great lines of dialogue could be contributed by the infamous script doctor. I always think that when I see a movie that has four screenwriting credits, I know what has happened is two guys worked together on the screenplay, and it was okay. But then the producer didn't like it as much, so he sent it to two other guys. And so four guys, half the screenplay is two guys, half the screenplay is the other two guys. They never met. The two pairs never met. So it's a very weird thing. And some guy just wrote a book on the importance of the screenplay called The Schreiber Theory, trying to debunk the auteur theory. And his great example is Casablanca, which I think is a wonderful example of a screenplay that, in fact, wasn't written by one or even two people. And so if you're going to hold up Casablanca as the importance of the screenplay, maybe so, but it doesn't work as the importance of the screenwriter. There's four credited screenwriters, but everybody knows the famous line at the end, this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship, was written by none of the screenwriters, but in fact was contributed by the producer, Hal Wallace.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, great screenplay, but it's a screenplay that exists from the movie. It's not a screenplay that you could actually read before the movie was shot.
Well, and apparently there are plenty of examples where actors have actually, in the course of making the movie, have decided, I don't like this line. Can I do this different? And the director, generally probably says, well, okay.
Sure.
And
so
they end up writing their own dialogue because they don't like what they have been given.
Absolutely. A writer, where the writer's important, is called the playwright. Where the writer is one of many is called a screenwriter. Now, obviously, you can't, the famous story of, you are some auteur, shoot this, and you hand him 100 blank pages. that's not the same. That's not to say writers aren't important, but really unless you're going to say, well, did you really write every word? I mean, it certainly happens where a screenplay is very good, and certainly there are screenwriters who are well-known. But, the script doctor is very, there are well-known script doctors and everyone knows. And it may just be structure. When I interviewed a famous director, Don Siegel, one time, and he's the first to admit that the screenplay was crucial. But the screenplay isn't necessarily the screenplay written by one or two people. It's the screenplay that you may shoot from that could have had many people involved. And then an actor improvises or director has a moment there, not to mention, obviously, the importance of the director. But it's a very strange thing. So, but that's why you have these guilds that try to look out for the importance of their contributors. But it's a funny thing about the caller's question about the producer, because that's the one that's becoming the most contentious. Too many producers.
One of the things that I think is noteworthy is that apparently it is possible for people, and there are people who have made pretty good livings writing screenplays that never get made into movies.
Oh, sure. There was a thing in Entertainment Weekly not too long ago about the five best screenplays floating around Hollywood. So now people even know what screenplays are good that haven't been made. But if you write a screenplay, it's going to be optioned, say, for $100,000, $200,000. That option is good for 6 months to a year. It doesn't get made. Somebody else takes an option out of it. Right? There you go. So, you know, it happens with books all the time. I would say, I really don't know because there's thousands of books published, but I would say many, many, many novels are optioned for screenplays, and the author and the publisher are going to split $15,000, $20,000 every 6 months to a year. And, of course, the vast majority never get made.
Yeah, pretty good. I got to get started on that screenplay. Our guest this morning is Dave Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at the U of I. And every once in a while, here we talk about movies, and we have some other folks here who would like to talk with us. Next is a caller in Chicago, and that, I believe, is line number one right here. Hello.
Thank you. I thought I'd follow through on some comments about some pictures that I enjoyed. And you were just talking about Casablanca. That happened to be written by an English teacher who was on summer vacation, as I understand, and was knocking off short stories for selling to magazines and so forth. So that one was written up and picked up by Hollywood and went on to become the classic that it is. And I was wondering if you ever knew if they were ever going to make a sequel to that. They're making sequels for everything under the sun. But are they going to make a sequel to Casablanca, have you heard?
They have never made an actual sequel, but they have made minor remakes, semi-sequels. But in terms of a sequel that follows sort of Rick and Louie to fight the Germans, they never have. But it's been remade for TV. It's been remade. There's actually a Charles Bronson version.
Oh, yeah.
And there's also the strangest reworking. Now, I don't want to say remake, but the strangest reworking of Casablanca stars Pamela Anderson called Barb Wire. So you never know where these things will show up. But a sequel per se to Casablanca is not one that I've ever heard of. But, you know, you're absolutely right that they are not only making sequels to big budget recent movies, but they have been sort of sequels
to variations on the theme, yeah.
Oh, definitely variations, absolutely.
Another comment about the original question, like which came first, the chicken or the egg? And I guess it's the answer to that is the rooster. The idea of who came up with the idea falls back upon the principal creator of the story or line or whatever. And I'm reminded of having read Breakfast at Tiffany's by Capote as a novel. And it came to me that it would be a nice story to be made into a movie, and it sure was followed through and made into the classic that it is. And then another one that I read in a magazine article was Charade, and that story got picked up and made into a movie, too. So several other things have come along the line that, lo and behold, they caught everybody else's fancy and was made into a movie. I just thought I'd pass those lines along to you.
You know, in the classic era of Hollywood, I think people don't realize that many, many movies were adaptations of once popular novels and many short stories in magazines. They really, really were. And writers you wouldn't. I mean, if you look at the credits, you'll see, you know, adapted from a story by so-and-so. And there's just no way that anyone has ever heard of that particular story. So there were many more magazines, popular magazines in those days. There was a lot more fiction available. My favorite example of where you find a story idea is from a nonfiction magazine article that was turned into a very interesting fiction film, and that's Saturday Night Fever. was based on an article about, you know, these kids in Brooklyn who, you know, go to disco and what that means to them. So that's, you know, again, a nice, not a fictional story, but take an idea from real life and turn it into a very interesting film.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to Urbana. This is line number two.
Hello. Oh, hi, how are you?
Yeah.
In reference to the producer question, there was a film made by, well, Terry Gilliam was making a film about, it's called Lost in La Mancha, and
right.
about him trying to make the film The Man of La Mancha with
right.
Johnny Depp, and there's this whole thing in the film about how all these people show up later in the, you know, early in the film with all their, you know, the producers, whatever you want to, money people.
Right.
Very interesting, if you can just sort of, it's like it's a documentary.
It is, right.
But
right.
What I always thought was interesting about the film is by listening to this show, over the years you have producers come in and, you know, directors that show up every once in a while, and how collaborative an effort it is, and how can you really pin any one individual, maybe, I mean, actors always think they're important, you know, the importance of what, I think it's like a collaborative effort. So.
It is. Yeah.
But another thing I was going to say that do you take suggestions for film, or have you seen, what you were talking about, the script writers, I saw an interview with Larry McMurtry and his partner, the writer, and they were talking about Brokeback Mountain. And I've always thought that in certain instances, he and her, I guess, together, plus the interpretations by the actors, I mean, they really made that film. If you watch, if you listen to their interview, and they were on like a Sunday morning shootout on AMC, and then you follow his career, his writing, you know, with the films he made earlier, I'm trying to think of off the top of my head, but how important their words to the actors were, but then the actors flip it and interpret that. So there again, you're back to that collaborative effort. So I'm really just surprised any films ever get made anyway. But just when I look at this stuff, you listen to all the mechanics of making a film.
Oh, yeah.
It seems like, well, when do they decide to stop? I mean, because you have editing and you know more about this than I ever would, but it just seems to me like when you see the end result, you wonder, you know, like I've seen actresses say, well, I thought this was good, but when I saw the film, I thought, I don't remember that. I mean, why did they edit that? You know, that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's a fascinating field, just a fascinating subject.
It is a very collaborative art, and I couldn't agree more. The problem is, I think, is that people naturally want to find somebody they can attribute it to.
Or blame.
Yeah, or blame.
Yeah.
Or blame. I agree with that.
Yeah.
But the one of the things about the collaborative nature is that's why you'll find, even in the classic era of Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
you'll find directors and producers like to work with the same people.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know, especially cinematographers, especially editors. That's why cinematographers are very well paid, editors are very well paid, because they're so important to the collaborative nature that no director would ever deny, at least in public, the importance of the cinematographer or the importance of the editor. The person who's really careful about this, it's a really good example, is Woody Allen.
Oh, yeah.
Over the course of his career, it's not just that he will use, you know, for many years Diane Keaton, or for many years Mia Farrow, or for many years himself. Now he's on to Scarlett Johansson. But the way he'll use for film after film for many years, the same cinematographer.
Yes, I
editor,
agree. Mm-hmm.
Costume designer. Production designer, not just the obvious sort of, you know, editor, cinematographer, but, you know, Santolo Quasto.
Yeah.
There you go, and of course it's because they give him what he wants, but he knows that they'll do a good job.
Yeah.
When George Lucas was on his way up,
mm-hmm.
the person that really, really helped him with a lot of his technical stuff was the sound guy named Walter Murch, who became so important also to Coppola. Lucas and Coppola, you know, sort of began as sort of
together.
Friends and all, that Walter Murch becomes associate producer by the time his career is along, because he's not just the sound designer and engineer anymore, and now he's such an important collaborator. But, you know, and that's the thing, and that's why also they give Academy Awards to these people.
Yeah, I agree.
And but it's such a collaborative art, I agree. And that's one of the things that I do like about the special features on DVDs.
Yeah.
Is directors, I sometimes want directors to talk thematically.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was trying to do this. I wanted to say this, but they often don't talk thematically.
Mm-hmm.
But when they do talk technically, it becomes very interesting. So one of my favorite movies of all time, actually, is this crazy action movie called The Warriors. And I bought the special edition DVD of The Warriors, and I listened to some of the interviews and discussions. And the most fascinating one was actually the cinematographer. And he was talking about a scene in Central Park where the Warriors are being chased and it's night. And he said, you know, there aren't that many lights in Central Park at night. And there certainly aren't enough lights in Central Park to shoot a movie by. So I hung lights in the trees. And he says, now you see them running and there's the lights in the trees.
Yeah.
And you just don't even think about it when you see the movies. Like, why are there lights in the trees in Central Park? Central Park is mighty safe at night, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's just like, you know, what is the director going to do when he says, I have this great idea for a chase scene through the park at night. Mm-hmm. And then someone says, but you can't see anything at night. So one of my favorite scenes in the movies was made because the cinematographer had this, you know, brilliant idea of let's put lights in the trees.
And you're right, again, because I was going to say about Woody Allen, because I just saw Match Point, and how I've known for the years, I've seen almost everything he's ever made, and he just uses the same people, because they really give him the look. Plus, I think they're probably, you know, reliable, too.
Oh, yeah.
They work together, and that goes back to that collaborative thing. It's a fascinating field, and you're touching on, earlier, when you were talking about producers, it's really, like any art form, you see the end result generally, but you don't see all the mechanics, the money, convincing someone to invest, and that's why I thought of Lost in La Mancha, because it brings all these like 30 people in. You know, they look like the wealthy, you know, ultra liberals from the East Coast, and they just show up in Spain. It's just a really Morocco, I think, maybe, or Tunisia, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, thanks a lot, David. It's a really good show. Thanks.
Yeah, sure.
Now, one of the things that's funny about these guys that come, the creative people call them the suits.
Yes.
The suits from the East Coast. And this whole business about collaboration and you work with the same people, you know, that's what the studio system essentially was. If you were a contract director at Fox, you know, you had a group of actors, you had a group of writers, you had cinematographers, editors, and that's just the way it worked. You know, and in the 70s, when it was really very interesting time in Hollywood, you had a lot of good directors who made a few good films. The majority, not all, but the majority of the directors who you really liked and found interesting in the 70s never or didn't quite sustain those long careers. Take John Ford. John Ford made his first film in 1917. John Ford made his last film in 1966. Okay, so now John Ford is a little bit of a, but even Alfred Hitchcock made his first film in the late 20s, made his last film in the 1980? How do these guys sustain careers? Well, part of it was over the years they were in a studio system that they could find and have scripts that they could mold, collaborators that they could work with. But overall, the system was in place that allowed them to make these good movies. Now, I'm a subscriber to the auteur theory, where, you know, you can recognize a John Ford film without much trouble. But you can also recognize a 20th Century Fox film without much trouble. And that's where this collaboration comes in. And the inability to sustain these long careers, I think, is because it's difficult to find quality scripts, quality collaborators, spend the time. If, you know, you say, well, I found a good script, right? You say, I want to make a movie. I found a good script. Well, the suits are going to tell you, yeah, it's a good script, but it needs to be rewritten. And then, you know, the script, now I have the 10th draft of a good script. So probably everything good about it is gone. Then you have to raise the money. Well, I think I can do this for $10 million. Okay. Which is not a drop in the bucket, but still, I have to do this for 10 million. But then you got to get you have to find the director, the actor. Everybody has to be hired from scratch. It's a process where you almost want to give up. One of the things that's interesting, you know, you talk about these independent movies like Junebug or Somebody's. It's not a surprise. The vast majority of independent movies, people's first features they also wrote them. So it's a personal project. Then the more successful they get, they may have less to say, and then they become dependent on, you know, finding good scripts and finding all those things. That's just much more difficult. You know, I'm an admirer and, you know, of Woody Allen, and I've written a book that's, you know, 25% about Woody Allen. But to me, it was not a surprise that his career begins to peter out in the 90s after, say, 20 films, because he may be needed a fresh start. I always said that either A, he should direct somebody else's script, or B, you know, collaborate more often. But mainly I said, you know, I'm surprised that he's kind of done so well with Matchpoint. But also, you know, he removed himself from New York and his usual cast, so he kind of got a fresh start in that way. But, you know, there's only so many times where you can say, well, gee, Woody, I think I've heard this before. But, you know, again, that's the difficulty of, you know, finding that much to say. A lot of people who are independent that become big-budget filmmakers are really not as good. It's just very hard to sustain a career in the chaotic filmmaking world, especially when, you know, it's almost easier to make a $150 million film than it is to make, say, a $30 million film. So $150 million film, you imagine, has a worldwide audience. And you imagine those first 2 weeks are going to be pretty good for you. Whereas a small film requires a whole lot more handling. and if, you know, a small film isn't going to get the all-important first weekend. I mean, the economics of big-budget Hollywood movie making, I think, are insane. And it really has squeezed out that middle-budget film.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's because that middle-budget film isn't going to have... Imagine what would have happened. I mean, I think the movie is only average, but my big fat Greek wedding, which everyone knows, right? Well, what if that movie relied only on its first 2 weeks? You know, then it grosses $8 million. But because it has its first 40 weeks... It grosses 80, and that's the, you know, the economics. But it's easier to open a big movie. So Mission Impossible 3 grossed a disappointing $40 million.
A disappointing.
Well,
$40 million.
It's disappointing, but it's all relative. So, right. But you know, if it's going to be a disappointing $40 million, if the second weekend it falls off 50%, then you've got a disappointing 2 weeks of $60 million, and now you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean by the economics. So in some ways, it's a very chaotic. But, you know, movies, you know, David, you were talking about screenplays that never get made. Mm-hmm. There are scripts that just drift around for years and years, or ideas that directors have in their head for years. I remember Martin Scorsese talking about how many years he wanted to make a movie about Howard Hughes. And when he finally did, well, that's another story. Mm-hmm. But still, the whole idea of these things can take, you know, it'll just take years and years to get off the ground. And when the money is so big, you know, as I say, they'd rather make a huge budget movie than a middle budget movie.
We have as our guest this morning Dave Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois. He is, in fact, director of the unit for cinema studies and is very much interested in American cinema and also in Asian cinema, and has written a number of books on these subjects, and questions are welcome here. We're talking about movies. You can tell us what you've seen, or if you have other questions, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Before we get too far away from it here, we had someone who called. You were talking earlier about producers and all the various people who are involved in making the movie. And this is a question I'm sure many people ask this question. They want to know about the gaffer and the best boy. The two people who you do see the in
yes.
if you read the credits, you see these two names come up, and I know that people always look at them and think, well, what do these two people do?
First of all, they should make good salaries, which is why budgets. But the gaffer belongs to the cinematographer, and he's part of the electrical lighting crew. And the best boy belongs, I forget who he's under, but the best boy belongs to basically, I think, the production and art department, the sort of the head carpenter. But the gaffer for sure, belongs to the cinematographer, the lighting guy, so he's the electrician, and the best boy is kind of like the head carpenter, although there is something called lead carpenter and things, yeah. But the best boy is that thing. So okay. That's a... you want to know about Foley editing and ADR and...
I don't know. You want to talk about those things?
So post-production. Post-production is where, you know, because there's so many elements to a movie these days that, you know, post-production only begins... Years ago, you might say post-production begins with the editor. For me, post-production ends with the editor in the old days. Now I would say post-production begins with the editor, because all of the other stuff, or all those people, you know, effects and music and tracks and cleaning up this and post-dubbing, right? Actors come in to dub their lines, and then you need ADR as additional dialogue recording. and all this stuff that just takes forever and ever. And, of course, the whole world of the music. Where are you going to put in sound effects? You know, basically you lay in, I mean, of course, it's many, many tracks, but basically you have three sort of primary tracks. You have your dialogue track, your music track, and your effects track. And that's why you can send movies overseas for dubbing, where your effects track and your music track is exactly the same, and all you do is change the dialogue track. So all these things are, but if you think about every, all those tracks need their sort of their own crew at the back end. And of course, the more effects you have, it's just unbelievable now.
Well, when you're shooting the movie, is most of the dialogue or all of the dialogue recorded as the actors speak it?
It is, but it's not always used. It provides, I mean, in Hollywood, in some cinemas, it's not recorded on set at all. In Italian cinema for many years, and even today, the Indian cinema won't record live sound at all.
So somebody then goes into the studio afterwards and loops it.
And loops it in. That's right. And now what they'll do in Hollywood is they'll record it live. In many instances, they'll use it. For location, they probably will use some, depends on how much they can clean up for background noise, white noise, and traffic noise, dropouts and things, so that for the most part. But I think Hollywood likes to do it so that when the actor comes back, they can also hear their own voice as well as match their lips. As opposed to, I think, in India, it's much more difficult to sort of, you know, well, I can't do it on the radio. But, you know, someone is just talking, and then, of course, in India, it might not even be the person whose voice is dubbed. But, and, of course, Italian cinema was notorious for that. Mm-hmm. Regional accents or some – there's some great Italian films that everyone really loves, but half the stars are French. And so they're not – you know, they're co-productions, but the French star is not speaking Italian, so they just dub him in. Mm. So that's the way it works. So they will record live sound, but they may not use – any of it or all of it, and just do, as I say, back in the post-production.
And then all the sound, not the music, but the other sounds, background sounds, explosions, gunshots, traffic noise, birds singing, all that kind of stuff, does all that get fiddled around with and added in?
Yeah, most of it's added in. If you go on a set, they'll have a gunshot, but they'll basically be using a cap pistol just so that they'll have that moment that it goes off. But all sounds of explosions, all sounds of traffic noise in an American movie are all laid in. At the very worst, they may be recorded live. You want some of that ambience, but they need to be, the word sometimes is sweetened. Yeah. You know, bring it up, bring it down, you know, totally. Well, that's how, you know, you can have voice, sometimes voice sound totally, it's called ambience. So if we have sound recorded here, it has a certain kind of timbre to it. But maybe you want a moment in which it just sounds like our voices. So you take out the ambience. And of course, you want music over, music under. So all of that has to be fiddled with. But mostly that's part of the effects track, and that's basically all laid in later.
All right. Let's talk with another caller here, someone in Urbana, line one.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I just got back from a brief visit to Paris, and we saw previews to Over the Hedge, and of course they had it in French, but they're still advertising Wanda Sykes and William Shatner, and I was wondering how those big-name stars go over when they are actually in the movie that they see.
That is strange. For most children's movies overseas, of course, they dub them into the foreign language.
That's what they were doing.
Yeah, that's right. But I have no idea why they could, unless they just took the same advertising that they're using here.
Well, that's what it looks like.
Yeah,
to me.
But I don't think that as much as I love Shatner and Wanda Sykes,
you don't think they should be speaking French in the movie?
Well, I don't think it's really that much better than mine, and we don't want me speaking. So that's an interesting thing. Now in France, you know, not so much for an animated movie, but France is one of those places where they'll dub movies or they'll leave them in the original, and then they'll say if it's in, you know.
Yeah, sometimes
I like that
subtitled, but it's
right.
Called Our Neighbor's Man it's not even called Over the Hedge. Everything is translated.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love foreign. I mean, I would like to sort of do a study on what they call films overseas. And you just can't imagine sometimes what they're thinking when they make these titles. So
well,
I agree.
I got to go.
Thank you. Well, then now there seem to be more and more animated films. And one of the things is that we have big time movie stars doing the voices for the films.
Yeah.
In, say, a film like that goes to another country. Say, you know, they decided to show it in Italy, mm-hmm. and they have Italian actors dub the lines. Do they bring in people like Roberto Benigni and people who are big-time Italian stars, or do they just get voice actors?
They don't generally bring in famous actors, but they do have well-known voice actors because of so many. The importance of American cinema overseas, and in places like Italy, they prefer dubbing to subtitling. So it's a fairly well-known that some major American actors will be dubbed by the same person in the respective countries. So the Tom Cruise's voice is always done.
It'll always be the same.
Right, but it's
voice.
Not generally done by Gerard Depardieu, for instance. So that's the way it works. But in their own animation becoming more and more popular overseas as well. But in Japan, of course, where animation is huge, they have voice actors who are extremely well known. But it's rare that voice actors cross over and vice versa. Whereas in this country, you know, it is the case that the big stars are doing these animations. You're right, but overseas it's not.
All right. To another caller here, Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was at Ebertfest, and once again, there were some movies that were difficult to understand the dialogue. It was interesting which ones I could understand and which ones some other audience members could understand. I thought it was the movie Somebody's I missed a lot of because it was set in Athens, Georgia,
right.
And it was African-American speaking. I'm not sure there were any whites in the movie. I could understand a lot of it, but there were some crucial jokes that I missed. and then it was the kids' movie, which was... in Great Britain, I don't remember what part of Great Britain had British accents. And I guess I've heard those more frequently. I was able to follow more of that. But the kids thought that those were American actors speaking in a British dialogue accent and that they couldn't understand them. I wish that's more understandable, but I wish that even in some mainstream movies, I can't always pick out the dialogue, and sometimes if I watch it on TV, I turn on the captions, the closed captions,
mm-hmm.
if I'm having difficulty. I wish that the people doing these movies would have somebody who doesn't know what they're saying listen to them and say, I can't understand your movie, and record it so that it would be more clear.
Well, that's an interesting thing. One of the things that happens, though, I think, especially in a movie like Somebody's, is the original elements that they have may not be as good. So it literally may not be as clear as it should be, and that you might be able to go back and fix it. But if they made the movie in, you know, digital video and then transfer it to film, that kind of thing. So the original elements might not be as clear. Second of all, I think that's why the closed caption feature is so very popular. But there's a sense in which regional accents, I personally think, can add to the movie. So if the people are speaking clearly and the sound is recorded and reproduced clearly, then not being quite able to pick up what they say or understand what they say can be very interesting. I remember when the Art Theater in Champaign first opened, one of their earliest films was called... it was set in Liverpool, something about Leningrad. Oh, the title just went out of my head. But when they first began speaking, they used the heaviest Liverpool accents with Liverpool slang. And I said to myself for about 15 minutes, I'm in trouble. But after a while, I got used to it. I could figure out what some of the slang meant. But I really appreciated this kind of glimpse, as if I went to Liverpool and people started speaking, I might have trouble understanding what they said, just as maybe heavy accents in Georgia would also. I mean, my father, for instance, can't travel in the South. He doesn't have a clue what these people are saying. It's just a matter of not being used to that. And so I think if a film does that, maybe it does that not so much deliberately, but it adds to the atmosphere of the film.
Yeah, I agree. But I guess part of what's setting me off is that a couple times I've gone to Krannert Center to hear groups like Sweet Honey in the Rock, Indigo Girls. I couldn't understand what they were singing. It's as though you're supposed to know what the song, what the words are. You're supposed to listen to their CDs and know what the words are.
Well, that I think is true. I think you're supposed to have done that indeed.
Well, I said to one of the performers at Sweet Honey in the Rock afterwards, I said, I couldn't understand you most of the time. And she said, well, it's your problem.
Oh, okay.
So I talked to a number of people. Everyone I talked to in different parts of the theater could not understand her. It wasn't just them. It wasn't just a matter of where I was located. Mm-hmm, and I also know I had just had my hearing checked the year before. I don't think it was my hearing. I think it's also that, at least with performances, that they use these feedback monitors that muddy up the sound. In other words, they have these speakers directed to the performers.
I was surprised. I went to a Broadway play, and not a musical, but an actual play not too long ago in this fairly small theater, and I was surprised that the actors were mic'd. When I was a kid, I went to Broadway a lot, and they never had microphones. You learn to project. And I think there's a combination of people might not very well be enunciating any longer because they think that the sound is going to be picked up by mics, you know, and they use mics up at the top now. They don't, you know, they don't carry wireless mics with them. So it may very well be that you ran into a case, and especially maybe the, remember in some bodies, the actors are amateurs. Mm-hmm. So indeed, not being able to understand them would be the combination of the way they really speak and not understanding how actors need to, actors can still have accents, but they can still be very clear. So what Terrence Howard was doing in his Memphis accent in Hustle and Flow was, that's a good Memphis accent, but you can understand everything he said because he's a good actor.
Yeah.
Instead of someone from Memphis and you say, oh, I don't understand a word this guy is saying.
Well, I wonder, too, if there's some carryover. I said to one person that I couldn't understand a musical performance, so I've gotten used to not understanding the words. So I wonder how much of that is carrying over to theater, if people not being used to not understanding.
No, I agree.
The words. Anyway,
I agree.
And there may not be crossover. It's just something that's been bugging me lately. Thanks a bunch.
Okay. Let's go to Belgium here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get back to your topic about the credits. And I've noticed it seems anymore they put everybody in the credits. Even the cleaning lady gets into the credits.
That's correct.
Is it so they make more money? Or is it, what's the reason behind this?
No, I don't think that's that they make more money. I just think they determine at the end of the film that everybody who worked on the film literally deserves some kind of credit.
Deserves a name in it, huh?
So, and it also has to do with a lot of the movies would be what you might call subcontracted. And so, you know, for let's say the great post-production facility that Lucas owns, Industrial Light and Magic. So Industrial Light and Magic will have a post-production supervisor and he'll have a crew and then all the people. So, but it literally is the case that if you do work on a film, you will get a credit. I mean, that does include the drivers. It does include the catering service. But that's just the way it is, especially recognizing that people will leave the movie theater. And then when it comes to TV, where they have to show this stuff by law, they'll show it at about 5 times the speed and scrunch it all up so that nobody in the world could read it. So they meet the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law.
That's why it goes so fast. Then it goes.
That's why it goes so fast. They have to show it, but nobody cares.
Okay.
And so, but nowadays, I know one channel puts a little crawl at the bottom for like some window company. So the credits are, but that's why they have to show them. So it's craft rules. The industrial, what is it? IATSE, International Association of Theatrical Stage Employees.
So everybody gets their name.
Everybody gets a credit.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We're coming down the last couple of minutes here. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that the big summer blockbuster season has begun and that there will be a lot of movies and probably a lot of them pretty forgettable. Is there anything that will be coming up this summer that you think is particularly worth going out of your way to see? Or is there anything that really, for you, say it's on your list of movies that you really want to see?
Well, for the summer, I like to sort of keep up with what we imagine everyone else is going to see. So for me, the X-Men movie is the one that I want to see for the big blockbusters. Fast and Furious 3. Everything is 3 this summer, unless it's 2. but this summer is really characterized by sequels and remakes. It's really unbelievable. But the new Fast and Furious movie takes place in Tokyo, so I have to go see that one. but actually, I'm interested in the Chinese movie that's going to play at the Art, Chen Kai Ge's The Promise. So that ought to be a lot of fun. That'll be a kind of – it's a Chinese blockbuster.
This was – was it the biggest grossing movie to date in China?
In China, yeah. Which is interesting because it doesn't rely on big stars, say, unlike a Hero or a –
House of
Flying Daggers. So, yeah, but I mean, Chiang Kai-shek is a major director, and you know, lots of CGI, but also lots of manpower. So The Promise will be good. But there's a nice range of movies this summer, you know, a lot of comedies and all. But it does seem that Hollywood probably will have a big summer. But there's really, 12 movies that in some ways are sequels or remakes. And that's a lot. The only other problem that Hollywood might run into is that they're going to be releasing sometimes as many as 3 big movies on the same weekend.
So they'll be slugging it out.
Somebody will suffer there.
All right. Anything that you might recommend, movies that have had their release, but if you're going to go down to the video store, like they have videos anymore, the DVD store.
The DVD store.
I guess pretty much it is.
Yeah. Well, I want to put in a plug for Munich. The Spielberg movie, which I don't want to say was overlooked since it was an Oscar-nominated film, but I think it was in some ways underrated. It's an interesting film. I mean, obviously everybody knows Brokeback and Crash and Capote, but put in a plug for Munich. And at the end of the month of June, a movie that I think is fantastic if you're interested in some very oddball entertainment. It's weird, but not crazy, is a movie from 1965 called The Loved One. That's a spoof of Hollywood, a satire on the funeral business, and ends up being also a satire on the pet funeral business amongst the weirdos of Southern California. But it is absolutely hilarious. You wouldn't think in 1965 that Hollywood made something so vicious, so dark, and so funny. So The Loved One's coming out, I think, June 20th. It's never been available before. Certainly not on DVD, so The Loved One from 1965.
All right. Well, for now, we'll wrap it up. The balcony is closed, as they say, until the next time. Our guest is Dave Desser. He's professor of cinema studies and director of the Unit for Cinema Studies at the U of I. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.